It is going to be Evulse and their song, what is it, Call of the Void? Call of the Void.
No, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon. Bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We want to say that capitalism, which is the economic system that dominates America, has dominated America since its beginning, is a backward, stupid, vicious, barbaric, and reactionary system. And we want to further say that this system is going to fall, and that those of us who are conscious are working as hard as we can to bring it down.
Welcome back to Voices of the Iron Front. I'm DJ Red Echo, and today we're taking a sharp, unflinching look at anti-fascism in 2025. How these movements recruit, how they disguise themselves, and how communities like ours can dismantle their influence before it spreads. Fascism today is fluid, it's adaptive, and it's opportunistic. It doesn't always show up as a march or a rally. Sometimes it shows up as a sticker on a lamppost, sometimes as a meme. Sometimes as a club meeting on a campus you thought was safe. Now, this episode is focused entirely on that reality. We're naming names. We're digging into how extremist groups shape their recruitment pipelines. We're examining how universities have become modern backgrounds for ideological warfare. And we're talking about what communities, especially marginalized ones, need to do to stay grounded and protected. And near the end of the show, we'll pause for a 60-second ancestral grounded meditation, a moment to reclaim strength before we close with a call to action. This is Voices of the Iron Front. Let's get into it. Now, fascism in 2025 is not a ghost of the past. It's a living organism mutating in real time, adapting to new technologies and new cultural landscapes. To understand how to fight it, we have to understand how it moves. Let's start with the Proud Boys, because they represent one of the clearest illustrations of how extremist groups have evolved. Now, they brand themselves as the Western Chauvinist, a phrase deliberately engineered to mask white supremacy behind a thin veneer of cultural pride. Their public image often centers on fraternity-style bonding, beer drinking, male bravado, and political agitation. But peel back the surface and you find a structure designed for violence, intimidation, and street-level disruption. Now, Proud Boy chapters operate in nearly every state, and their involvement in the January 6th insurrection was not incidental. Multiple members were convicted of seditious conspiracy and violent entry. Their recruitment strategy leans heavily on grievance politics, hyper-masculine posturing, and cultivating young men who feel culturally displaced or resentful of progressive movements. They offer these men a sense of identity and a mission, And once that psychological hook is set, the political indoctrination becomes easy. Now, a Patriot Front represents a different but equally dangerous strategy. Emerging after the violent Unite the Right rally in 2017, which I was a part of, they became a splinter faction of the alt-right movement, determined to rebrand white nationalism with a clean, polished aesthetic. Their members appear masked, uniformed, coordinated, almost militaristic, and they specialize in propaganda operations, banners on highways, flyers on campuses, marches engineered for viral video. In 2021 alone, they were responsible for an estimated 80% of white supremacist propaganda incidents in the U.S., using constant visual saturation to normalize their presence. Their language is coded, leaning on American heritage, cultural preservation, and patriotism, all designed to create plausible deniability for extremist ideology. They aren't trying to debate anyone. They're trying to invisibly seed white nationalist sentiment across public spaces while recruiting young men through an image of discipline and belonging. Then there are groups like the Base, explicitly neo-Nazi, parliamentary, and internationally founded in 2018. Now, the Base has built a network through encrypted online platforms where recruits were invited into weapons trainings, survival camps, and ideological radicalization. They operated like a militia, encouraging members to prepare for what they call acceleration, a strategy designed to collapse society through chaos, violence, and destabilization so they can rebuild a white ethnostate from their wreckage. Now, the Base isn't subtle. They openly embrace extremist ideology, celebrate authoritarianism, and structure their entire movement around preparing for terroristic escalation. Their members have been arrested across multiple countries, and law enforcement continues to disrupt their activities, but the ideology they promote continues to spread online. And then you have Adam Waffman Division, one of the most explicitly neo-Nazi groups active in the last decade, and they provide yet another blueprint. Their early recruitment involved plastering flyers around college campuses with slogans like "Join your local Nazis," a shocking reminder of how brazen their outreach can be. Their ideology fuses neo-Nazism with apocalyptic accelerationism, and their propaganda often encourages violence outright. Now, what's important about Adam Waffen isn't just their operational history. It's the fact that their visual and meme culture continues to live on within broader online extremist spaces. Now, even when law enforcement cracks down, the ideas remain, recycled through new groups under new names. Collectively, these organizations show how contemporary fascism adapts to survive. It shifts appearance depending on the audience. Sometimes it shows up as a street gang in polo shirts and body armor. Sometimes it shows up as a disciplined marching band or mass nationalist. Sometimes it exists in encrypted chat rooms where young men bond over guns, racism, and fantasies of societal collapse. And sometimes it hides behind heritage clubs, free speech groups, or men fraternities that operate just close enough to mainstream culture to seem harmless. This is why awareness matters. If we don't know these groups, their methods, their aesthetics, and their recruitment strategies, we leave our communities open to manipulation. Fascism isn't just waiting for a big moment. It's recruiting in the quiet spaces, the overlooked corners, the places we assume are safe. Understanding these groups is the first step toward making sure they don't expand their reach into our youth, our campuses, and our communities. You're listening to Voices of the Iron Front right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. Stay locked. Welcome back to Voices of the Iron Front, right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Let's jump back into our previous conversation. And let's talk about this time universities and how they're used as recruitment grounds. Now, universities have quietly become some of the most contested spaces in the modern fight against fascism. Not because of what happens inside classrooms, but because of what happens around the emotional lives of young adults. College is one of the rare points in life where millions of people enter the same vulnerable transition at the same time. Leaving home, finding identity, confronting uncertainty, and struggling with belonging. Extremist groups understand this perfectly. They know that students are navigating loneliness, stress, insecurity, pressure, and cultural disorientation. They know students are searching for meaning, connection, and a sense of who they are becoming. And they weaponize those vulnerabilities, turning campuses into quiet battlegrounds where identity is contested long before ideology enters the room. Now, groups like Identity Europa, which later rebranded to hide its extremist roots, executed one of the most deliberate campus propaganda campaigns in recent history. They called it Project Siege, a coordinated blitz of flyers, stickers, banners, and uninvited appearances on campuses across the country. Now, their strategy was not to win debates. It was to seed presence, to make their ideology visible enough to feel unavoidable, but not explicit enough to get immediately banned. Their materials used classical statues, clean typography, and vague European heritage branding to make white nationalism look respectable, intellectual, even artistic. The Anti-Defamation League tracked hundreds of these incidents beginning in 2016, and many universities were unprepared for how deliberate the campaigns were. Now, fascist recruiters use campuses not because they expect easy conversions, but because they know students often lack community grounding during those first years. Freshmen especially are navigating a disorienting mix of freedom and fragility. Some arrive without friends, some feel disconnected from home, some feel overwhelmed by academic pressure, and some feel alienated within progressive campus politics. And fascist groups exploit that alienation by offering a sense of belonging rooted in grievance and superiority. Now, they present themselves as the voice of tradition, reason, or free thought against supposedly oppressive campus norms. They look for students who feel culturally or socially out of step. For those students, these groups often offer the illusion of clarity, a defined identity in a world that feels chaotic. Now, the Proud Boys have used this strategy repeatedly. While they're known for street fights and public intimidation, their quieter campus infiltration often happens through debate clubs, protest counterpresence, or informal networks built around anti-PC rhetoric. They latch onto this campus controversies, injecting themselves in protests and using online forums to encourage students to join them in defending Western civilization. Now, there are reports that consistent Proud Boys activity aimed at pulling young men into their orbit by stoking resentment about feminism, multiculturalism, LGBTQ visibility, and changing social norms. The formula is simple. Take a student who feels marginalized or ignored by mainstream campus culture. Tell him the world is stacked against him, and then offer him a tribe where he suddenly feels powerful. That's their tactics. That's how they move. Recruitment rarely looks like someone handing out swastikas. More often, it looks like a club forming with a vague language about heritage. It looks like invitations to private meetups where the conversation slowly veers into extremist ideology. It looks like Discord server promoting fitness and self-improvement but sharing fascist memes just a little too comfortably. It looks like a campus party thrown by people who just ask the hard questions, but those questions always circle back to race, gender, and identity in ways engineered to create resentment. One student who interacted with an extremist group described being quietly interviewed about his heritage, beliefs, and even his views on Hitler, all presented as an intellectual exercise. And by the time he realized he was being vetted for recruitment, the social hooks were already in place. Universities bear responsibility for this too as well, let's not forget. But many still don't understand what they're up against. They implement abstract hate speech training, but they don't train students on how extremist grooming works. They build diversity programs, but they don't build community networks strong enough to keep isolated students from drifting into extremist hands. Effective prevention requires transparency, consistent tracking of propaganda incidents, and reliable support systems for students feeling marginalized or lost. It also requires administrators to abandon the false neutrality that treats white supremacist recruitment as one viewpoint among many. Neutrality in the face of active manipulation is not what it is. It's surrender. This is where community allies like youth workers, activists, peer mentors, mutual aid networks, and local organizers become essential. Campuses that collaborate with surrounding communities are far harder to infiltrate because students have more options for belonging outside the narrow social silos of community of campus life. When young people have support access, they have support across multiple layers of their environment. Fascist recruiters lose their grip, and students themselves hold immense power. When they build anti-fascist coalitions, host awareness events, share information about propaganda incidents, and document suspicious activity, they close the pathway, the quiet pathways these groups rely on. The hard truth is that extremist groups don't need to convert a majority. They only need to build a foothold, a network of a few dedicated recruits who can then influence others. Campuses amplify that risk because small clusters of radicalized students can create the illusion of mainstream acceptance. That illusion becomes a gateway, and so the fight against campus infiltration must be proactive, visible, and persistent. It must speak directly to the emotional realities of students, not just the ideological ones. It must offer community where fascism offers tribalism, and it must also offer support where fascism offers grievance. It must offer belonging grounded in dignity, not domination. So in short, if we protect the hearts of the students, we protect the campus. If we protect the campus, then we also protect the community. And if we protect the community, fascism loses one of its strongest recruitment engines. You're listening to Voices of the Iron Front right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. We'll be right back.
Stop me!
Welcome back to Voices of the Iron Front right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. We just wanted to thank KBOO once again for giving us this platform to share with you, the audience. And we just want to let the audience know, as always, we appreciate your support. We appreciate you listening. And we offer whatever assistance we can to keep you guys informed, educated, and vigilant to your surroundings, your community around you, and how to be the best person in your community you can be. So with that being said, let's jump back into it. Now, fascism in 2025, it survives by slipping through the cracks we fail to notice, and community defense starts with closing those cracks. Vigilance isn't paranoia. It's clarity, pattern recognition, and the willingness to call out danger before it grows teeth. Modern recruitment rarely begins with a swastika or a shaved head. It begins with emotional vulnerability, identity confusion, and curated aesthetics built to look harmless. Some extremist networks now cloak their ideology behind fitness culture and brotherhood-style fight clubs. Also, tradition branding or online spaces that pretend to be self-improvement groups. A young person, especially a young male, might think that they're joining a workout circle or a men's support group when in reality the progression has already started. Ironic memes become serious ones. Heritage language becomes exclusionary. And suddenly the line between cultural pride and supremacist ideology has been erased. That is how radicalization works today. It works slowly, subtly, and socially. This is why our communities must shift from reactive to proactive. We have to talk openly with young people long before extremists try to. Conversations about identity, belonging, frustration, loneliness, and meaning can no longer be left to chance. When a young person understands how recruitment pipelines operate, how meme culture pulls them in, they also understand how brotherhood becomes obligation, and also how propaganda buries itself in humor. And that makes them far less susceptible. Media literacy is anti-fascist defense. Emotional literacy is anti-fascist defense. Naming the manipulation before it happens takes power away from recruiters who count on silence and shame. But knowledge alone is not enough. People need spaces that hold them. Fascism thrives wherever isolation grows. If a person feels unseen, unvalued, or disconnected from their community, they become perfect targets for extremist ideology that promises identity and importance. Because building inclusive spaces where people are supported, where differences are celebrated, where loneliness doesn't linger in the dark, isn't just community building, it's prevention. And also, when young people already belong somewhere meaningful, fascists can't sell them a counterfeit version of belonging. We also have to understand the terrain around us. Every neighborhood, campus, and online environment has a specific pattern of extremist presence. Now, Patriot Front, for instance, might rely on banner drops and sticking propaganda near busy intersections. Proud Boys might show up at a school board meeting or community protest looking to intimidate. Local heritage clubs, quote unquote, might be fronts for white nationalist networking. Mapping these patterns gives communities the ability to respond quickly, report effectively, and coordinate before tension escalates. That means youth workers, teachers, librarians, social workers, activists, and neighbors must communicate with each other, and they must share what they see, because that will be building a collective understanding of regional threats. And as we talk about protecting community, we cannot ignore the people doing the heavy lifting. Once again, those are youth counselors, mutual aid workers, crisis responders, organizers, and mentors, who often burn themselves out long before the work is done. And when the front line collapses, extremism moves in real easy. Community defense requires rest. It requires care. It requires mutual support systems so that the people protecting others aren't running on fumes. Sustaining the defenders is just as critical as confronting the threat itself. And finally, anti-fascism must always reach beyond the direct confrontation with hate groups. The most powerful form of resistance happens in structural support we build. It happens in stable housing, mental health access, harm reduction, food security, worker power, and youth leadership. Every resource we strengthen for vulnerable people is one less weakness for fascists to exploit. Anti-fascism is only standing against something. It's building something stronger. It's building something more humane. When communities have resources, fascism has no foothold whatsoever. And that is what vigilance really looks like. It's clear eyes. It's full hearts. It's strong networks. And most importantly, it's a community. You're listening to Voices of the Iron Front right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. We will be right back.
Yeah. I said then middle finger sky high, triple black, then I'm in overload. I don't overdose, I can smoke a hoe and still poke a hoe with no dough to blow. I ain't frontin' on the East Coast nigga with a thing for a round skin mama with a crazy post. Let the camera roll, let the carpet roll, but not touch the stove. Cook down so we tiptoe down, come around to your memory lane. With a fine tooth comb, let me sit in your brain. Cemetery with a blindfold, enemies hang. Bring a six pack, zigzag, rebel shit, cannabis. Five geared up when I bust a rhyme, but I'm off back, grind like a duck tip run. At the money store with a death grip, drip, zip knees, getting straight for that shine. So I let them do their job and let them take it down. Let them take it down. So I let them do their job and let them take it down.
Take it down, take it down. Oh yeah.
So I let them do their job and let them take it down. Take it down. Take it down. So I let them do their job and let them take it down. Take it down. Take it down. So I let them do their job and let them take it. Take it down. Down. So I let them do their job and let them take it down. Take it down. Take it down. So I let them do their job and let them take it down. Take it down. Take it down. So I let them do their job and let them take it down. We'll be right back.
high heels, walking from 59th and Addison to Spruce to catch the bus through gang territory with high heels and a wig on.
Alright, in school, all the way back to elementary school, I was always an artist, sort of the person.
He did, you know, he told my mom, why are you buying that damn guitar? He didn't like it too much, you know, I guess he wanted me to be like him, you know, going to the army.
Stinker was really making his own shoes and clothes, and we would pick up certain things. We were really thieves.
Started to collect sorts of albums like Funkadelics, Sly and the Family Stone.
That was David Bowie, early David Bowie stuff. Ziggy Stardust.
Sid Barrett era, Pink Floyd, and the Alice Cooper and the Iggy and the Stooges.
I was like, reggae, what's that? You know, like, so she gave me a big box of tapes. I said, you need to know these things. This is the bloody backbone of punk.
Also, Spider and Chip, we're all from the same neighborhood in West Philadelphia.
There was a friend there who was saying, hey, he knew I was into music, and he was telling me, hey, it's a guy that plays like Hendrix. And I was like, bullshit. And so that had to have been Chip.
Just getting on the bus one day on Chestnut Street, and Spider gets on the bus, and we started talking. He used to come over to my house and we'd listen to stuff. My room's all psychedelic out.
I used to go hang at Stinker's house. His mom used to let me do whatever I wanted in his house. And I told him, hey man, why don't you buy this guy's bass? We could start a band.
That was a thing, smoking pot, watching all sorts of movie, watching Dr. Shock.
And then our first gig, like I said, was at Lincoln Prep. I sang. And it was nice. I mean, for back then, we just rocked that whole place. The Dean, everybody was there.
This is a song that we like to do called I Feel Bad.
Reading the rock magazines, publications, rock scenes, and stuff like that. And that's how we get our information about the underground New York scene at the time.
So at one point, Spider had ran into Johnny and them guys somewhere to Schubert or somewhere on Broad Street. They were playing down here.
Him and Stinker went up to New York a couple times. And they was hanging out with, you know, people like, you know, the New York Dolls.
We knew we were outgrowing Philadelphia. So we really wanted to get to a real scene. So we tried to get to New York.
Rented a U-Haul, took all the equipment. It was on New Jersey Turnpike and the state police stopped us. Yeah, they opened the back and like all this smoke came out. You know, we're lucky we didn't go to jail that night.
Went to a club, I think it was called the 318 or 310 Club or something. And Johnny Thunders was in there. We're smoking angel dust or doing something. So then, you know, he offers us, you know, come over to their loft. So we goes there and we're jamming, you know.
Stinker had bass equipment, and we used his bass equipment to go in the studio. I sold my equipment so we can, you know, just, you know, live up there, eat.
We had changed our name to Pure Hell because the scene of New York and everything was sort of morphing from glam into a more street vibe.
And at the same time, I was reading an autobiography on Jimi Hendrix, written by Curtis Knight. And I really, really dug that book. And I looked in the back and I noticed his address was in the Village. I went straight to New York, straight to his door, knocked on his door, said, did you write this book? And he says, yeah. And I says, well, if you wrote this book, I got something for you. I got the band for you.
My first show as Pure Hell was at Mother's across the street from the Chelsea Hotel. Mind you, everybody was into Chelsea, and the scene was altogether different. The backgrounds with money, mixing with people that are artistic, and models, and actresses, porno actresses. And
we're not really a CBGB's band. We're more like a Maxis, Kansas City, Chelsea Hotel kind of art scene, underground spinoff, Andy Warhol type of Edie Sedgwick transvestite trip, you know?
Sid and Nancy entered the Chelsea. So it was only appropriate that we played with them.
Nancy had called and tried to counsel us out from opening up for Sid.
On comes the radio. British punk star Sid Vicious, you know, blah, 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 for the murder of Nancy Spungen. And we're like, oh, what the hell? Couldn't fucking believe it. I mean, it was a shock, being that we were going on tour. We just played with them. By the end of that month, we're on our way to Europe now. We're in the papers where Curtis has gone there and prepped all of that, and people know who we are. Then with this incident with Sid and Nancy, now we're on the second page of Melody Maker, New Musical Express, Sounds. So all of the European crowd is looking at us like, you know, an extension of the Pistols, and being of our being that we were black or so, it was all not a novelty, but it was all new. It was something to them.
So back then, they would spit on you if they showed your approval. I took off my bass at one point and tried to hit the first row of people in the aisle. They had to stop the show.
That reminded me of the boat ride to Holland when we had all these iron crosses and stuff on. And you know, we're on a boat full of Dutch people, you know, and it's like, you know, I mean, we didn't really, like, know, you know. We wasn't history majors, you know.
I was wearing all types of Nazi badges and stuff when we first came into Europe, and they weren't really liking us. I wasn't getting it because I was young. There were skinheads. Oh man, they were packy bashing, black bashing, so they were trying to tell me where I should go and where I shouldn't go.
After our second tour of that, you know, it was pretty much done for all of original punk. And I say, the Dead Boys were broken up, the Pistols were broken up. Then your record companies, your major record companies started to get a feel, started to catch up sort of to, like, you know, this whole new generation of stuff that's going on. A lot of people thought we were from England, you know, because that's where our record was released, and that's where we had major connections there. And it never caught on back here.
The Dolls broke up, and Giant Thunders and Jerry Nolan, they started the Heartbreakers. And so, you know, that's when we left the Loft, you know, the Greyhound bus, you know, running back, looking back at the city, you know, as you're leaving. And that was a pretty, pretty sad ride, leaving New York. But, you know, we did go back up there, like, you know, a month or so later.
About Marlon Brando, another Aries-natured person. It's called Wild One.
Next thing you know, Spider calls us in Hollywood, and we're like, whoa. And he's like, your tickets are at the airport. So we're like, wow, the shit is real. So we're all stoked. Yeah, let's go get some angel dust. So we went and got some angel dust. We're like, yeah, let's go to the train and smoke angel dust and get on the plane. So we smoked angel dust and missed the plane.
Wow. What's it going? What's the job?
Mike Schneider asks me, he says, you know, Stinker, do you know Henry Rollins? I says, are you kidding me? I said, yeah, I know who Henry Rollins is. He says, yeah, well, he's playing his stuff on his radio, the Indy station, 103.1, is that it, in California? And I'm like, what the hell are you talking, you know? Because quite frankly, when he told me that he had the masters of that first stuff, you know, all these years later, I was like, you know, do I have to kill this guy? I said, he's going to put this stuff out. And all these new kids that are out there now that are, like, you know, that are more, you know, advanced and everything now from that, they'll see that. He says, oh, no, this stuff is, like, you know, awesome. I'm like, so people like Noise Addiction, they're liking it?
It's like history. I mean, we're part of pop culture on the West Coast already. And we're not even from there, and in England, too, so it'd be nice if we really had that known here.
The first to say you love me. And I thought I should know.
Your 60-second ancestral grounding meditation. Take a moment. Sit comfortably. Breathe in deeply. And release slowly. Feel the ground holding you. Feel the strength of those who came before you. The ones who resisted, survived, and protected their communities long before our time. Their courage in your breath. Their clarity in your spine, their resilience in your inheritance. Carry that forward. And when you're ready, come back to the room. And that is your 60-second ancestral grounding meditation. Now, here's the final call to action, everyone. This episode didn't leave room for illusions. Fascism is active. It is adaptive. It is recruiting. But community isn't powerless. Awareness is power. Conversation is power. And also connection. The moment we understand how recruitment works, we can interrupt it before it touches the people we love. Now, know the groups. Know their tactics. And also make sure you educate yourself about the emotional traps that they set. Understand how they weaponize loneliness in young men, how they cloak ideology and culture. Also, how they embed themselves in campuses, in gyms, online spaces, community forums. When you can see the pattern, you can break it. And your role, whether you're a youth counselor, a student, a neighbor, a worker, or an organizer, is part of this fight. Protect your community by being present. You can ask questions. You can offer belonging, but most importantly, you can help young people learn to recognize manipulation early. Build networks where vulnerability is met with support, not exploitation. And remember, anti-fascism is not only resistance, it's creation. The community you build today becomes the shield someone else relies on tomorrow. On the next episode, we'll be diving into anti-fascist labor organizing. How workers across the country are building resilience against authoritarian pressure inside their workplaces and unions. Until then, stay vigilant, stay grounded, and stay connected, and stay dangerous to fascism. Until next time, KBOO family, all my love always. Peace out.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Be sure to tune into Radio Lost and Found, where many radio mysteries will be revealed. Radio Lost and Found is a 2-hour media scape of found sounds.